Beau wouldn't be back from her father's until late tomorrow. There were only so many weight machine reps you could do in a day. Might as well go chase a goose. The door swung open at her knock. Jillian Waters. Come in, kid. Great to see you. The coach stood a head shorter than Jillian, built like a fire plug. Close-cropped white hair, short-sleeved shirt, well-worn khakis, tennis shoes. His nose had the look of one that had been broken and reset more than once, more than twice. Come in, he repeated as he wheeled around and started walking away. She took a step in, closed the door, then had to half run to keep up. She was still confused by that greeting, like he just reconnected with a long-lost friend. Have we met? She said to his retreating form. Of course, he said over his shoulder. Just now. He abruptly stopped, turned, and faced her. Wait, you are Jillian Waters, right? She nodded. Okay, then. I'm George, the coach. He reached out, enveloped her right hand in his, and gave it one solid shake. Good to meet you. He turned back and took off again. She followed him through what looked like an entirely normal, if tiny, residential living room and into what would probably have been called a den, now refitted as a cozy office. George, the coach, slipped behind his desk, a huge mahogany and leather battleship of a thing that took up half the room, and gestured toward a comfy-looking mahogany and leather armchair. As she took her seat, she looked around the room. The wall was peppered with photos, all different sizes and at different heights, giving the impression that a madman had burst in with an oversized machine gun loaded with framed pictures and randomly sprayed the place. Some were of various sports greats. Jillian didn't follow sports as much as Beau did, but even she recognized some of these faces. And business icons. These she knew well, and they impressed her greatly. Every one of them posing along with a beaming coach. There were a few shots she recognized with some of the city's biggest philanthropists. These impressed her most of all. Welcome to the dugout, said the coach. Several small shelves built into the wall sported trophies, one of which consisted of a gleaming pair of boxing gloves clasped together. Were they gold-plated? The coach noticed the direction of her gaze. I started out as a fighter, and a pretty good one. Though, here he pointed to his own nose, not always good enough, as you notice from my busted schnoz. Jillian blushed. Had she been that obvious? Those were my hard-driving days, he continued. Raised a lot of hell, won a lot of rounds. Went pro for a while, too. Eventually got civilized. Ended up working as a high school coach. Boxing, wrestling, football, baseball, soccer, you name it. But you didn't come for my resume. You said you wanted to talk about the winning strategy. Good. Did you say you were a journalist? No, wait, he continued before she could reply. No, you're in business, an executive at that big pet place, Smith and Banks. Yes, said Jillian. I'm a buyer there. And don't tell me. You want to buy something, and you've hit a snag? He sure didn't waste any time getting down to it, did he? She liked that. That about sums it up, yes. Okay, then. He settled back in his chair, so she did likewise, and immediately thought, wow, that was one seriously comfortable chair. I know, right? He said. Orthopedic or something. Amazing, right? Had it made special. I want my visitors to feel well taken care of. He took a gold-plated pen from its holder and began fiddling with it, as if to keep up with his thoughts. Jillian couldn't help noticing his hands. They looked like a pair of catcher's mitts. That's just shorthand, you know, winning strategy. The full term is the winning strategy for getting your life on track. No offense, said Jillian, but I don't really need a strategy for putting my life on track. I just need to get this contract I'm trying to land. That will put my life on track. He smiled and nodded. I see. Okay. He glanced at the watch on his wrist. I have to be somewhere in about 10 minutes. That gives us 5. So let me sketch out the big picture, then you can see if you want to know more. Good? Jillian tilted her head in a slight nod. Sure. Right. So the strategy boils down to two words. Positive. Persuasion. Jillian blinked. Aha. So I found the goose, she thought. At least he wasn't an axe murderer. Okay, she began. Just how is positive persuasion a winning strategy? He asked. Good question. In sports, winning is about competition, right? In business, winning is about collaboration. Jillian was not so sure that was true, but she held her tongue. So then, he continued, what's the key to effective collaboration? That one was easy. Compromise, she said. He smiled and nodded again. Smart kid, shook his head. Not so sure about that one, though. Here's what I learned in school. Compromise comes from a Latin word meaning everybody ends up with something someone else thought would be a good idea, and nobody ends up with what they really wanted. Okay, that definitely did not sound right. Which school was that? The words escaped her lips before she thought about it, and she hoped they didn't come off sounding too rude. He leaned forward and intoned, "The University of Obdurate Adversities." He noted her puzzled look with satisfaction and nodded, "Ha! A.K.A. School of Hard Knocks. There's no such Latin word, of course. I made that up. But it's pretty much the truth." Jillian laughed despite herself. She had to admit it was a pretty good definition. When she and Beau's father split up, the lawyers had talked on and on about the need to come to a reasonable compromise. And the coach's definition did in fact accurately describe what they both ended up with. So, persuasion, she said. How so? Persuasion, he said, is the substance of collaboration. You take two people, any number, really, but for now we'll just say two, who are not entirely in the same place, okay? So for them to come together, at least one is going to have to do some persuading to get the other side to shift their position. At least one, and probably both, if you want to know the truth. Forgive me, said Jillian, but how is that different from outright manipulation? He pointed at her with his pen and nodded. That's an excellent point. How indeed? They're cousins, in a way. Only they're opposite cousins. Similar on the surface, opposite at their core. Manipulation is about getting someone to do what you want them to do, for your reasons. Persuasion is getting someone to do what they want to do, for their reasons. Take coaching. I meet for 12 weeks with a team of 14-year-old boys on the baseball field. Most of what I do, frankly, is persuasion. These kids want to play ball. They want to play a good game, a great game. They want to improve, to excel, to become their best selves, right? They want all that. But it doesn't happen, not unless I'm there. Why not? Because there's a lot of stuff that gets in the way. Most of coaching is just removing the stuff that gets in the way and reminding them of what they wanted to do in the first place. Jillian thought about her work with Katie. Was that what Katie did? Just remove stuff in the way? Like her excuses? Excuses, for example, said the coach. Scary. How the guy could read your mind. Lack of esteem, bad habits, less than ideal health, good old-fashioned laziness, distractions, temper, worrying, all that stuff gets in the way. He shrugged. I take it out. Coaching. Persuasion. Now, if I were trying to get these kids to become child soldiers, take up weapons, and go wipe out the city, I think we'd probably agree that that would qualify as manipulation. But that's not what they signed up for. I help them to do what they signed up for. A manipulator can have employees, but never a team. Customers, but seldom loyal or long-lasting ones. Friends and family, but rarely relationships that are genuinely happy and fulfilling. Because those who manipulate are, whether by nature or simply by habit, guarded, suspicious, filled with resentment. And how can you be happy when that's your constant state? Wow, thought Jillian. Did he just describe Craig to a T or what? Persuaders and manipulators are both skillful at reading other people, and they both use that skill to influence others. The difference is, manipulators seek to influence for their own gain only, while a positive persuader uses it to the other person's gain, too, and not just their own. How do you know the difference? He nodded. Right, so there's something a manipulator will do that a positive persuader will never do. A manipulator will play on your negative emotions in order to elicit your compliance. If you don't play ball, they'll try to make you feel silly or foolish or guilty, naive, selfish, or whatever other negative emotion will work in the situation. They'll push whatever buttons they can find that will make you squirm and want to cry uncle. Jillian cringed inwardly. Push whatever buttons they can find to make you cry uncle. She hadn't felt great about making Jackson Hill wait an extra 11 minutes for their meeting. And then using that Mr. Hall ploy to keep him on the defensive? That felt downright creepy. But she'd needed to make the meeting work, right? Maybe it wasn't only Craig whom the coach was describing. The coach spoke this next so softly that it almost felt as if he were just thinking the words to her. This is not necessarily malicious, he said. People often do this with the best of intentions, trying to get you to do something they genuinely think you ought to do, that you'll appreciate doing, that will benefit you. They're just resorting to manipulation because they don't know any other way. Jillian was looking down at her hands. But it works, she said quietly. Yes, he said. Yes, sometimes, in the moment, even for a time, but not in the long run. Never in the long run. Manipulation might sometimes win the game, but it never wins the game. She looked up directly into his unblinking eyes. I'm sorry, but I have absolutely no idea what that means. Although she felt that she did know, too, in a way she most definitely could not have explained. The coach looked at her for a moment, then reached out one of his baseball mitt hands and placed it palm down on the desk between them. The gesture oddly moved her, though she did not know why. It was a gesture that seemed to say, here, I'm meeting you halfway. I'm willing to offer my help, but only if you want it. And I am safe. Definitely not an axe murderer, Jillian thought. The coach glanced again at his watch and stood up. Gotta go, he looked at her. So? Then you can see if you want to know more, he'd said. Time for an answer. She nodded uncertainly. I have to admit, you've got my curiosity going. But executive coaching, he held both hands up, palms facing her in a hold-it-right-there gesture. Not actual coaching. For now, just a quick map of the territory. First thing Monday? Jillian's heart sank as reality seeped back in with the word Monday. I'm sorry, I have such a totally full day, I don't see... What if you swing by early on your way to work? 8, maybe? We'll meet at the juice bar down the block. Last building on the row. Jillian shrugged. Sure, I mean, I guess. There was no way she could afford to be late for work Monday, but how could she refuse this generous offer? You won't be late, said the coach. 5 minutes. 5 minutes and a delicious glass of fresh-squeezed juice. Best deal ever. You're buying, I'm talking. She laughed. You're very persuasive, George. What she was thinking was, 5 minutes? What can we possibly accomplish in 5 minutes? He smiled. I can count everything I know about winning in business on the fingers of one hand. And yes, I can share that with you in 5 minutes. He held up his right index finger. Or at least a finger's worth. Scary, she thought, how the guy really could read your mind. The thing is, added the coach, once you learn about the winning strategy, you won't be able to unlearn it. And it'll change how you think. Do you want that? Of course, replied Jillian. Though as she thanked him and exited the little building, she wondered. Did she?
Chapter 6. Master Your Emotions. Monday morning at 8 on the dot, Jillian strode to the last door on the row under a sign that read, The Juice Caboose. and immediately wondered if she'd made a mistake. George, the coach, stood leaning up against the juice bar, chatting with a scruffily dressed patron. Jillian herself, decked out in an immaculate suit, silk floral scarf, crisp cuffs, and classy pumps, dressed as she always did for work, was looking like a consummate professional. George was in sweats. He looked like he was ready to hang out here all day, chatting away. Jillian groaned. She'd never get out of here in time for work. The coach raised one catcher's mitt hand in greeting, gave a big grin, and pointed at his watch. "We have 4 minutes and 45 seconds left," he called out. A few blocks away, Jackson Hill stood uncertainly on the sidewalk, gazing at the storefront entrance and checking the address for the third time. "Come by my office," the judge had said. This was definitely the address she'd given him, but he saw no hint of any kind of office building. He'd thought the address was familiar when she gave it to him, and now he knew why. He'd been here before, of course. Who hadn't? He looked up again at the sign over the door. There was the iconic huge letter R, and underneath it, three words that had in the past decade become recognizable around the globe. Rachel's Famous Coffee. This is weird, he thought. Where was her office? In some space above the restaurant? Or out back? But he didn't see any other entrance or sign indicating either one. Maybe someone in the place could help him. He hoped so. He stepped inside. Briefly scanning the menu emblazoned high on the wall of the juice caboose, Jillian chose a glass of carrot, beet, and apple, with spirulina and an energy shot, whatever that was. She also asked for an espresso chaser, but the server looked blank and said, "What?" "Never mind," said Jillian. The server asked the coach for his order. "Celery juice," he said. "Just celery." He gestured down the counter toward the back of the place and said to Jillian, "Let's sit over there, out of the way." Jillian paid for their juices, then followed to where he had taken the last seat, way at the end of the counter. The coach took a long pull on his glass, draining it nearly to the bottom. He looked like he'd done this 1,000 times, a fighter cozying up to the bar after a tough match, tossing back shots of celery juice. He set the glass down. "So, the winning strategy," he said. "For getting your life on track," added Jillian. He nodded. "Touché." He held up one index finger. "First secret," he said. "Breathe." "Breathe? That's it?" He nodded again. "Breathe. Is there a wild goose loose in the juice caboose?" she thought. "Okay," she said, nodding. "Breathe. Got it." "Let me see," said the coach. "What, you want to see me breathe?" The coach just inclined his head slightly. "Well?" Jillian took some quick exaggerated breaths, in and out, 3 times, then 4, then 5. She stopped and looked at him. "Okay?" "No, no," he said. "I mean, breathe. Here." He pushed his stool back and placed his left palm over his abdomen. "Put your hand on your belly, like so." He took a deep, slow breath in, and as he did, his hand moved out. As he exhaled, his hand moved back in toward his spine, like a bellows. Jillian did likewise, then a second time, and a third, all the while thinking, "Why?" "Okay," said the coach. "Not bad. Not great, but not bad. My first boxing coach showed me an entire catalog of techniques. How to parry, feint, block, different combinations, everything in a boxer's bag of tricks. None of it mattered. I could have learned it all out of a book. Already had, in fact. But he taught me 2 things that opened up my world and took my game to a whole new level. He taught me to nap, and he taught me to breathe." To nap, repeated Jillian. To nap? Oh, she knew all about naps, and they were a great winning strategy, all right. For when her sweet beau was way overtired and hitting the wall, and Jillian was about to pull her hair out. Oh, I know what you're thinking, said the coach. Naps are what you make your kids do when they're over the edge exhausted to give yourself a break. Jillian sipped her juice and said nothing. But my coach taught us that knowing how to take a short nap is the secret to an even temperament and to health and longevity. Even a 10-minute catnap in the middle of the day, he said, will extend your lifespan by a decade. I've been doing it every day since. Duly noted, said Jillian. Uh-huh. She could just see it now. Mirabel, hold my calls for the next 15. Jilly's got to go nine-nine. And he taught us, the coach was saying, to breathe, really breathe, from the diaphragm, so that all the old air departs and all the new fresh air joins the party. It's the secret to great delivery on stage. My boxing coach also taught opera singers. Really, said Jillian. So, said the coach, you know what the purpose of all that was? The naps? The correct breathing? Oxygenation? Better health? I give up. Control. Not the forced kind of control you impose from the outside. Genuine control. The kind that can only come from the inside. Jillian put her juice down. This was the first thing he'd said since they sat down that had piqued her interest. Control how? You've seen ball players lose their temper on the field, go nuts, scream at the officials, throw their bat or racket. Jillian had indeed seen that. Who hadn't? Well, the smart ones never do. Even in the boxing ring, in a sport whose identifying trait is for the fighters to hit each other, you never lose your cool. Because you're not there to lose it. You're there, in fact, to do the opposite of losing it. So, you breathe. You stay in control from the inside. And that is the key to effective persuasion. You don't lose your cool. You find your cool. You breathe. He drained the last swig of celery and set the glass down with a thud. That's it. Gotta go. He stood. So, you'll swing by again tomorrow morning? He stepped away from the counter and started heading out of the place, Jillian following. There's more? There's more. I thought you said you could tell me everything you knew in 5 minutes. He stopped, turned back, and held up one index finger. She frowned, thinking back. What had he said? Or at least a finger's worth. Oh, right. He smiled. Let's call it 5 minutes per secret. So, he held up that same big mitt again, this time with all 5 fingers extended. So, 5 more minutes tomorrow? And with that, he was out the door. Breathe, thought Jillian, and nap. Stupendous, as Beau would say. At least she wouldn't be late for work. As she exited the building at the end of the row, Jillian Waters decided that her first visit to the juice caboose was also her last. She would leave the coach a message later, with her regrets. She already had enough wild geese to chase this week. Once the 3 parties in front of him had all placed their to-go orders, Jackson Hill stood at the ordering counter at Rachel's Famous Coffee and asked the barista if she had any idea where Judge Henshaw's office was. The young woman laughed. I do, she said. A very good idea. Right there. She gestured over Jackson's shoulder. He turned and saw she was directing him to a small round table in the corner, where there sat a lean, strong-boned woman with great cascades of deep auburn hair. The judge, in living color. He turned back to the barista, whose name tag said Holly, and said, Thanks, Holly. My pleasure, said Holly. As he made his way to the table, Jackson paused to take in the decor. The place was simple, but elegant. Deep, natural wood tones, soft lighting, spit shine clean. The walls were punctuated like a high-class gallery with breathtakingly beautiful photographs, all of them shot in black and white and artfully lit, of children of varying ages. Very atmospheric. "Welcome to Judge's Chambers," said that deep, husky voice as he approached the table. She reminded him of some wonderful 50s film star, Lauren Bacall, Kate Hepburn. He took a seat across from the judge, and a server appeared instantly to take their breakfast order. The judge ordered 3 croissants, 2 spinach and cheese, 1 almond, and a carafe of coffee, black. Jackson had the oatmeal. "So," she said, "natural negotiation." "Right," he said. The woman certainly got right to the point. "Natural negotiation is a type of contract. Before I was a judge, naturally, I spent years working as a lawyer." "Oh, right," said Jackson. This had never occurred to him before, but of course, every judge was first a lawyer, right? "Like caterpillars to butterflies," he mused. "Caterpillars to butterflies. All right," said the judge with a slight smile. "Therefore, I naturally think in terms of contracts and clauses." "Okay," said Jackson. "You're making a contract with the other party." "No," said the judge. "Let's not get ahead of ourselves. Natural negotiation is a contract you make with yourself. You can't successfully come to agreement with another person if you can't first successfully come to agreement with yourself. Every dispute is first and foremost a dispute with yourself." The server reappeared and began setting down their dishes, and Jackson was grateful for the interruption. He wanted a moment to process what she'd just said. Every dispute is first and foremost a dispute with yourself. The judge proceeded to demolish the first of the spinach and cheese. Perhaps she sensed Jackson's need to process, or maybe she was just hungry. After a moment, she dabbed at her mouth with a paper napkin, took a swallow of coffee, and continued. "In any contract, the first clause comes first for a reason. It lays the foundation for everything that follows. If you don't have agreement on the first clause, then the rest will tend to unravel. In the contract of natural negotiation, the first clause is this: master your emotions." She paused to take one more swallow of coffee, then continued, "A dissertation from the bench. In responding to a situation of conflict or disagreement, the most critical first step is to set your feelings to the side. Not deny them, not suppress them. You can still have your feelings. You don't need to change them or even try to do so. Just set them off to one side for the moment, so that reasoned judgment may prevail." "Okay," said Jackson. "I think I've got that." The judge looked at him. "All right." Another swallow of coffee. Then, "Do me a favor. Walk me through your meeting Friday, from the beginning." Jackson nodded. "Okay." As he began describing his meeting with Ms. Waters, how she got his name wrong, how she kept looking down at her papers and not at him, how she made telegraphic little statements that somehow made him feel defensive, quite the entrepreneur, somewhat unconventional name for a business, his face flushed. He pushed his plate of oatmeal aside, put his elbows on the table, and hung his head on his fists as he talked. He wasn't hungry anyway. He hadn't really eaten all weekend. "You're upset," said the judge. "I guess so. Talking about it now, yeah," said Jackson. "At the time, though, I stayed pretty calm." "Well, I'm sure you did," said the judge. "On the outside. What did it feel like on the inside? Close your eyes if it helps you remember." Jackson closed his eyes. But you understand, Ms. Waters was saying, we're a national chain. Would that be fair to our customers? And Jackson wanting to shout at her, would that be a rhetorical question? He opened his eyes. Yeah, pretty upset, I guess. She set her coffee cup down and looked at him. The first clause isn't about acting like you're mastering your emotions. It's about actually doing it. Not seeming calm, being calm. She took a moment to dig in on spinach and cheese croissant number 2 while Jackson poked at his oatmeal again. Tell me something, she said. When was the last time someone cut you off in traffic? In fact, this had happened to Jackson barely 20 minutes earlier, on his way into town. And how did you respond? She asked. Well, said Jackson, I called him something I'm not especially proud of and would rather not repeat. Her eyes danced with laughter. Let me guess, at a respectable volume level? Oh, yes, said Jackson, very respectable. I'm surprised it didn't shatter my windshield. Now she laughed out loud. He grinned, too. All right, she said. Can you remember what you felt like at that moment? Jackson could, and vividly. Clenched stomach, pounding heart, heat rising to his face. He described this to her, and as he did, he felt an echo of the same feelings all over again. What if I told you, she said, that the other driver had just at that moment learned that his child was on the way to the hospital in extremely grave condition, and he was trying to get there as fast as humanly possible? But you don't know that, objected Jackson. No, she agreed, I don't, nor do you. In fact, you have no idea what was or wasn't going on for that driver. Your reaction wasn't based on the facts of what happened, but purely on your own feelings, which are not always entirely trustworthy. But he could have gotten us both killed, said Jackson. But he didn't, countered the judge. He cut you off, and as far as the evidence is concerned, the facts stop there. More to the point is what you did. What do you mean, what I did? You shouted so loud you thought it might crack your windshield, she said, smiling. You shouted your feelings out loud, inside your car. In your meeting, you shouted them silently, inside your head. Either way, it's still shouting. You were out of control. You could have gotten you both killed. Jackson was silent. She put her hand on his arm. It's okay to have your feelings, Jackson. You don't even have to change them. All the first clause says is, you just have to set them to the side. They can be along for the ride, but in the passenger's seat. Because if you let your emotions drive the car, then you're at the mercy of a drunk driver. The judge poured herself more hot coffee from the carafe. When you go downtown at rush hour, she said, what do you hear? A grand cacophony of car horns, bleeding, honking, blaring. It's the quintessential urban sound signature, right? Jackson nodded. All those feelings, driving all those cars. She shook her head sadly. It's no wonder the world needs judges and mediators. Conflict is everywhere. Alas. And it's entirely understandable. It's how we're wired. Fight, flight, or freeze. After a moment, Jackson said, so if that's how we're wired, well, what do? She smiled. We rewire. Scientists call it neuroplasticity. I call it, well... She raised her eyebrows at him as if to say, what would you call it? Mastering your emotions, he said. She smiled. It takes time to retrain your default response. Time and repetition. Practice. But it works. Every time you're successful at responding by unruffling your feelings, it strikes a chord inside. It's like thrumming the low E string in a guitar, and you are a song in the key of E. You experience a sense of trueness, a sense that says, "This is me, the real me. This is how I am in the world." And it changes your brain a little bit at a time. It wires new connections, cuts new pathways. In time, you make calm your default setting. And as you do, you become more you. As Jackson thought about that, the judge set about quietly making her last croissant disappear. "So, that's clause number one," observed Jackson. "There must be more, yes?" "Yes," she dabbed at her lips with a napkin, then said, "Shall we meet again tomorrow? Right here, same time?" Jackson suddenly felt his face flush again. Somehow it had not occurred to him until this moment. This was a professional consultation. Obviously he would need to pay for these minutes. How could he possibly not have thought of that? They'd been talking for close to an hour, and now she was talking about continuing the next day? He was already one session in. Was it too late to back out? Of course it was. What would Walt do here? Jackson knew exactly what he'd do. He would wait for the judge to name a figure and then give her the flinch. Could he possibly do that? The idea made his stomach clench. But what else could he... Driving drunk? What? Jackson looked up at the judge, who was sitting still, watching him. For a long moment, he was completely confused as to what she was talking about. Finally, his frown relaxed into a sheepish grin. "Oh, right. Feelings definitely not in the passenger seat," he said. "Not so much," she agreed. "So, not so calm, maybe," he said. "Maybe not." They both smiled. She touched her hand lightly to his arm again. "It's okay to have your feelings, Jackson," she said once again. "You don't even have to change them. Just don't let them get behind the wheel." "Right," said Jackson. "So, I asked you if you could meet with me again tomorrow, and you had what I would judge to be a mild cardiovascular event. May I ask?" Jackson took a breath and let it out. "I was thinking about, well, your consulting fee. I don't know what it is, but I doubt I can really afford it. I mean, of course I expect to pay for today, but..." He trailed off. When she was sure he had nothing else to add, she nodded and said, "Jackson, if there were a consulting fee, I would have said so. This conference is pro bono." Jackson's face fell. Was that how bad his situation was? "So I'm officially a charity case," he said. "Not charity, pro bono. You know what that means?" "It means no charge." She gave an irritated shake of her head. "I wish they didn't use the term that way." "Technically, yes. But that's not what the phrase really means, and it confuses the issue. Pro bono means for the good. Giving a service away for free isn't the same thing as doing good. It's just not charging. As far as I'm concerned, all the work I do is pro bono, regardless of the fees charged, and I can levy a pretty weighty fee. No, Jackson, in this case, consider our time together as a gesture of gratitude from my husband's cats." "Wow," said Jackson. "Okay. Well, thanks. I mean, you're welcome. Or they're welcome, I guess." He took a thoughtful sip of his water, then looked at her again. "So, you use your powers only for good, like a superhero." She looked at him for a long moment before she said, "Exactly. That's exactly right, Jackson. Like a superhero." like you. Jackson nearly choked on his water.
Sorry?
Look at what you do, she said. Look at your clients, your angels clothed in fur. Look at the people whose lives you touch through your care for animals. Jackson sighed. Animals, I understand. It's the people I sometimes have a hard time getting. Once more, she put her hand on his arm. Every one of us is a superhero, Jackson. Every one. It's how we're designed. Most of us just don't realize it. That evening, after Jackson had gotten into bed and Solomon had settled himself down, after first turning in a slow, complete circle the obligatory 4 or 5 times, Jackson took out a small blank ledger book he'd taken with him everywhere he went that day. His plan had been to start assembling data on in-stock quantities and reorder dates for each account, so he could begin the process of working out his graceful withdrawal from their shelves. The book was still blank. He pondered the front cover for a moment, then wrote on the title line, "My Contract with Myself." He turned to the first page and wrote, 1. Master your emotions. Set your feelings to the side. You can still have your feelings. You don't even need to change them. Just set them aside for the moment. Don't let them drive the car. Put reasoned judgment in the driver's seat, feelings in the passenger seat. Retrain yourself to respond to conflict and disagreement by unruffling your feelings. Make calm your default setting. He thought for another moment, then said aloud, "And remember, everyone is a superhero, whether they know it or not." Solomon, by now more than half asleep, let out a deep breath and said, "Woof."
Chapter 7. Step Into Their Shoes. Tuesday morning at 8 o'clock, Jillian Waters stood on the sidewalk at the end of the row, glaring up at the sign that said, "The Juice Caboose." "You're crazy, Jill," she told herself. She pushed open the door. "Crazy or not, here I come." "You're back," commented the coach. "You're surprised?" said Jillian. "A little," he admitted. "When we parted yesterday, I sensed a smidgen of, let's call it, healthy skepticism." "Huh," said Jillian, wearing as neutral a face as she could. "Pear, beet, ginger, pineapple, and an energy shot," she told the young man behind the counter. "Hold the espresso." "What made you change your mind?" said the coach. "A few deep breaths," said Jillian. The coach chuckled. "Celery," he said to the counter guy. Jillian wasn't joking about that. After their conversation the day before, during a brief lull at work, she had placed her hand on her abdomen again and done that slow, deep breath. It had occurred to her that during her meeting with Jackson Hill the previous Friday, she could not remember taking a single decent breath. What she didn't say was that her mind kept returning to the coach's little office where they'd first met on Saturday, and especially to the walls, those golden gloves. He was a fighter, she thought. She liked that. It made her feel like they were kindred spirits. But that wasn't what changed her mind and brought her back for a second round of fresh-squeezed juice. It was those pictures on the coach's wall, those incredibly influential pillars of the community. If that was the kind of crowd this man ran with, then he was someone she couldn't afford not to listen to. Once they were settled at their spot at the end of the counter, and the coach had drained most of his glass, celery juice, best when drunk in the first 60 seconds, he set his glass down and held up 2 fingers. "Winning strategy, second secret, okay?" She nodded. "Okay." "Listen." "Listen?" "Listen. Not just with your ears. Listen with your eyes, with your posture. Listen with the back of your neck. With the back of your neck, she repeated, feeling ridiculous as she did, wondering if he was going to say, "Let me see," again. The coach cocked his head and regarded her for a moment. "When I say boxing, what do you see?" "Someone throwing a punch." "Throwing a punch, okay." He tipped his glass and drained the last dregs of juice. "I have a friend who's a former Special Forces sniper. What do you suppose he spent most of his time in training learning how to do to a level of unparalleled mastery?" "To shoot." The coach nodded. Where was this going? Wondered Jillian. "And a CEO, a person responsible for a major business employing hundreds, maybe thousands of people. What does she do there all day in her corner office?" What does she do there all day in her corner office? Those words sent a thrill of goose flesh up Jillian's arms and the back of her neck. Was he describing the future Jillian Waters? And how the heck did he do that? "She makes the tough decisions," she replied. "Aha," said the coach. "And so you'd think. But it's not the case." "No?" said Jillian. "No. Here's the interesting thing about boxing. Most of it is not about throwing punches. Most of boxing is watching the other guy, sensing what he's about to do, sensing what he's even thinking about doing." He paused as if waiting for Jillian to add something. So she did. "Listening with the back of his neck," she said. "Exactly. And shooting a rifle makes up a tiny, fractional portion of what an expert sniper actually does on the field. Most of his time is spent in reconnaissance and observation, which is why he spends an enormous amount of training time refining those skills and not just marksmanship." "And the CEO? Yes, you make the tough decisions, write big checks, take big actions. But if you're a smart CEO, mostly what you do is watch what's going on in your company, in other companies, in the market, in other markets, in the world. What's happening? What's about to happen? What's even thinking about being about to happen?" "You listen," she added, "with the back of your neck." The coach cocked his head again for a moment, then lifted his empty glass and clinked it lightly against hers. "A toast to your acute perception." "The mistake so many people make when it comes to persuasion," he said, "is that they think you do it with what's in your head. Mostly, though, positive persuasion is about tuning to what's in the other person's head." Jillian flashed on her meeting with Jackson Hill. Whatever was going on in that guy's head, it was still a mystery to her. "But people can be so opaque," she said. "How can you know?" He looked at her and spoke one word. "Listen." She sighed. "The most effective leaders," he said, "are those who are the best listeners. The same is true for the most effective teachers and the most effective parents, too. They are experts at listening." Ouch, she thought. Was she an expert at listening with Bo? She thought so. She hoped so. "Gotta run," said the coach, and he was up and out the door. As she gathered herself and got up to leave, a thought occurred to Jillian. Maybe he doesn't read minds at all. Maybe he's just a really, really good listener. A few blocks away, Judge Celia Henshaw was ordering a frittata with diced asparagus, feta cheese, dill, and scallions. "The oatmeal," said Jackson when the server asked for his order. "You're sure you won't have anything else?" said the judge. The coffee carafe was already in front of her, and as she poured a blazing hot cup for herself, she nodded toward a second empty cup, offering to pour for Jackson. "Most delicious coffee you'll ever taste." Jackson held up a hand. "No, thanks." "Frittata?" she said. "Croissant? Crust of dry toast and water?" He laughed. "I'm good." She took a swallow or two of her most delicious coffee, looking at him over the cup's rim. A man of simple tastes. Jackson blushed and shrugged. "Before we get to the second clause," said the judge, "tell me, in your negotiation with Ms. Waters, do you have a sense of what's at stake here? A solid sense?" Jackson shrugged again. "Sure. I mean, I think so." She made an "after you" gesture with one hand. Well, the fate of my company, basically. Whether I can continue going on as I am, or maybe expand enormously. Or, well, shut down. She nodded. All right, I see that. Now, what are the stakes for her? He stared at her. The stakes for Jillian Waters? It hadn't occurred to him to even ask himself the question. Now that he tried, he was coming up blank. I have absolutely no idea. Ah, she said. So maybe not so solid a sense? Jackson thought for another moment, staring at his oatmeal, then looked up at her again. Wow, he said. She nodded. Sobering thought, I know. I can't tell you how many cases I've heard over the years, thousands, where neither party had given the first thought to why the other person was there in court. I mean, their reasons why. Which is why, in the natural negotiation contract, the second clause is this. Step into the other person's shoes. Get out of your own thoughts, your own concerns, your own issues, and step into the other person's perspective. Make a concerted effort to appreciate where they're coming from, what's at stake for them, to see the world the way they're seeing it, which is guaranteed to be different from the way you're seeing it. It's always helpful to see the other side. If you don't, it's like driving through the city with your eyes closed. You know where you're hoping to end up, but you have no idea what's on the road in front of you. And frankly, the prospects for safe passage are dim. Jackson pictured what she was describing, heard the startled bleats of horns, the shouts, the crash and crunch of metal and plastic. Mayhem, he said. Then he added, driving blind, even more dangerous than driving drunk. She laughed, that butter and honey on toast laugh. Really well put, she said. The frittata arrived, and the judge dove in. At the first bite, she closed her eyes and said, oh my, the woman is an artist. Incredible. They ate for a moment in companionable silence. Then the judge spoke up again. You've heard people talk about the elephant in the room? Jackson was familiar with that expression. The problem isn't just that nobody is talking about the glaring issue in front of them. It's that they're all seeing a completely different elephant in the first place. Really? Said Jackson. How so? She gave the now empty plate an appreciative glance and dabbed at her lips with a napkin, then set it down and looked at Jackson. Every one of us sees the world through our own set of lenses, she said, our own belief system, our personal worldview, usually without even realizing that we're doing it, and all the while expecting that everyone else is seeing it all the same way we do, which, of course, they're not. You know the park in the middle of town? Jackson nodded. He knew it well. He and Solomon often took long walks through that park. Have you ever noticed the statue of the elephant? I love it, he said, nodding again. At the park's very center, there stood a great statue of an elephant surrounded by four blind men all touching different parts of the animal, a leg, the tail, the trunk, and a tusk. The Elephant of Babel, I call it. She laughed. Yes, as the four described the magnificent beast to each other, she said, each one is absolutely convinced that the others are crazy, and that his view of the elephant is the correct one. When I was a lawyer, I represented Pindar, the man who commissioned that statue. Pindar, thought Jackson. Wow. He didn't follow the business world much, but even he had heard of this guy. Everyone had heard of Pindar. Mentor to multitudes, they called him. When I first interviewed for the position, the judge continued, he took me for a brown bag lunch, which we ate sitting on a bench facing that statue. In situations of conflict or disagreement, he told me, most efforts at communication are little more than one blind man trying to get another to see the elephant the way he does. It's a lesson I've never forgotten. If something is open to interpretation, I can promise you that two different people will interpret it differently, sometimes very differently. And that makes genuine communication almost impossible. Her words reminded Jackson of something he'd read. "Like Shaw," he murmured. "Hmm?" said the judge. "George Bernard Shaw," said Jackson. What he said was the single biggest problem with communication, the illusion that it has occurred. She laughed again, and Jackson chuckled briefly, too. "To be honest, though," he added, "I thought that sounded kind of depressing." "Depressing how?" she said. "Well, like you said, it means that real communication is impossible." "Almost impossible," she corrected. "And it's in that tiny gap, the space between impossible and almost, that we get to roam and find each other, which is actually quite thrilling territory to explore. Take you, for example. When Ms. Waters said they wanted an exclusive on your products, what do you take that to mean?" "That I'd sell them through her company," said Jackson, "and nowhere else. You know, exclusive." "Did she say it would have to be 100% exclusive?" "Well, she didn't specify 100%, but isn't that what exclusive means?" "I don't know. Is it?" When Jackson said nothing, she added, "Also, did she say it absolutely had to be an exclusive contract?" He thought back, trying to replay her exact words. "We would want it to be an exclusive." "Want." Did that mean the same thing as absolutely had to be? "Not in so many words," he said. "But, listen, they see me as a small player. They don't care about my existing accounts. They don't see them as people, friends I've taken years to get to know. They see them as extraneous distribution points on a graph, an arithmetic problem to be sorted out." He felt his face starting to flush again. "Who's driving the car right now, Jackson?" "Ah," said the judge. "And you know this all how?" "Well," he began and stopped himself. How did he know that was all true? Was it? "At the close of your meeting," said the judge, "if I remember right, she suggested you go back and talk with your accounts and see what you could work out. What did she mean by that?" "She meant they wanted me to..." He stopped himself again. "Gracefully withdraw from future commitments," was what Ms. Waters had said. But what exactly did that mean? And was it a completely non-negotiable condition? Did exclusive mean exclusive? He had no idea. The judge spoke softly now. "You said they see you, by which I assume you mean Ms. Waters sees you, as a small player. Tell me, how do you see her?" Jackson thought about the weeks of delay leading up to their meeting, about the extra 11 long minutes of waiting in the reception room, about finally getting into her office and her not even looking up to greet him. "Honestly, I see her as an unfeeling, uncaring, the girl, the photograph on her desk, the girl and the cat with the eyes. She has a daughter, I think." The judge didn't say a word, just listened. "A little girl with the most solemn eyes. Looks like she's seen some sad moments in her little life. And is really close to her cat. And what a beauty. The cat I'm talking about," he added. The judge nodded. "A Russian blue. Amazing animals. They are super intelligent, sensitive, shy, almost reclusive. But man, do they bond with the person they're close to. Some people call them archangel blues. And you can see why..." He trailed off. "And you see her how?" asked the judge after a moment. He looked at her. "As a mom, I guess." He shook his head slowly. "And one tough businesswoman." He gave a quiet laugh. "And that's about all I know, I guess." She nodded. "Well, Jackson Hill, sounds like you have some shoes to find."
Chapter 8. The Corner Office. Just as Jackson stepped out of Rachel's Famous Coffee and stood on the sidewalk, gazing at the clouds and thinking about what the judge had said, Jillian arrived at her office building and walked into reception, where Mirabel was hanging up the phone. "Corner office says he can fit you in," she said. "When?" said Jillian. "Right now." Nothing like advance notice. Okay, Jill. Breathe. Listen. With the back of your neck.